Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Novelist Elliot Ackerman served 5 tours of duty in Iraq and Afghanistan as a junior Marine Corps officer, receiving the Silver Star, the Bronze Star for Valor, and the Purple Heart during his service. But it was one day during the battle for Fallujah, an intense urban battle on par with the worst urban fighting back in Vietnam during the Tet Offensive, that haunts Ackerman and permeates his memoir, Places and Names, on War, Revolution, and Returning. In 2013, Ackerman returned to the Middle East, this time as a journalist, covering the Syrian Civil War. But he also returned to Iraq, where he retraced his journeys as a rifle platoon officer, culminating in a return to Fallujah in 2016, 12 years later, and several battles later, as the city continued to be a battleground, as ISIS and Iraqi forces fought over this ground. Elliot Ackerman is the author of 3 highly regarded novels, all informed by his service in the Middle East, most recently Waiting for Eden. His writings have appeared in Esquire, The New Yorker, The Atlantic, and The New York Times Magazine. His latest book is titled Places and Names. He'll be appearing at a Book Smart Tulsa event tonight at 7 o'clock at Magic City Books in the Tulsa Arts District. He joins us by phone here on Studio Tulsa. Elliot Ackerman, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rich.
Your first story in Places and Names involves coming face to face with a man who, if only for the vagaries of time, might have been someone you would have faced on the battlefield in Iraq, an Al-Qaeda fighter named Abu Nasser. How did you come to meet him?
I came to meet him through another friend of mine, a gentleman named Abed. And Abed was a Syrian democratic activist who was living in southern Turkey, where I was doing a lot of my reporting from. And he had met Abu Hassar in a refugee camp. And he basically came to me and said, you know, Elliot, I met a guy who I think you should meet. And I said, okay, Abed, who's the guy? And he said, well, he fought for Al-Qaeda in Iraq, but I feel like the two of you would really get along. So we set up that meeting between Abu Hassar and I, and the idea of the meeting was that two veterans of the Iraq War would sit down and have a cup of tea together, except we'd fought on opposite sides of the war.
Was that something you were keen to do at the time, or?
It wasn't something I was looking to do, but when the opportunity afforded itself, I immediately knew that it was something I wanted to do, because I had this deep curiosity as to who Abu Hassar was, you know, who this person was, who had fought against me, and had, you know, in that respect, really been the other half of this experience that had been so defining for me.
And as you met him, when Abed left at one point, you just took out a napkin and traced the Euphrates River, mm-hmm. and you found this piece of common ground. Would you tell us that story?
Sure. Well, you know, when Abu Hassar and I met, it was sort of, again, on this gamble that there wouldn't be any antipathy there, that there would really just be this recognition of that we had had this common experience. And so what I thought would be an hour-long cup of tea turned into about 4 hours of conversation, you know, us asking each other, one another, everything. You know, when were you the most afraid? What was it like fighting against us? What was it like fighting against you? But at a certain point, my friend Abed, who had been translating the entire time, looks at us and said, you know, guys, I need a break. I'm tired. He got up and went to the bathroom. And suddenly, as intensely as Abu Hassar and I had been talking, we couldn't communicate. And, you know, I'd say we were probably about as awkward as 2 13-year-olds on their first date at that point. So I drew this line on the map, which was the Euphrates River. Then Abu Hassar wrote a name next to a place on the map and a number next to it. He handed me the pencil, and I realized what he was doing. And I put a number next to his number, and the same thing in another place, another number. I put my number next to his number. And sort of as we once chased each other around that part of Iraq, our hands were now chasing each other around this map, because what we were trying to see was if any of our numbers matched up, because those numbers were dates, trying to see if we had fought at the same place at the same time.
Now, what did you learn from that experience? Abu Hassar shows up a little later in your book as well. You run into him again. But what were you trying to understand about his experience?
Well, to go back to the incident I just mentioned, you know, at that moment when we were sort of trying to find out if any of the places and dates had been the same, what was obvious to me was that at that moment, you know, even when we didn't have a translator, we didn't need one, because we had this common language, and it was a common language defined by the place names and the dates. And so what I was looking to really get out of that experience and those interactions with Abu Hassar was to just understand the common ground that existed between us, because we had been defined by this experience, which was the war in Iraq, even though we'd fought on different sides of it.
Yeah. And of course, as you're having this conversation through the course of the afternoon, it was trying to understand, almost understand your enemy in a way, you know, why we couldn't defeat you, why they couldn't defeat our side. It was this sort of understanding because there was, seems like there was sort of going through some misunderstandings about each other through the course of the conversation.
Certainly. And, you know, I think we're also having, he and I had these conversations over a series of about 3 years. And during those 3 years, we saw the rise of the Islamic State, their sweep from Syria into Iraq, and we saw the Syrian revolution failing. So he and I are having these conversations about our wars from 10 years before in the context of a war that's unfolding in front of us right now. And as much as we had that common experience, too, when we would discuss politics, you know, we didn't have common ground anymore, and we had a lot of ideological differences that we still have.
This book, Places and Names, this is your first piece of nonfiction as far as in book form, a memoir of essays, in many cases describing, written at a time when you're working somewhat as a journalist in and around the Syrian Civil War, but also a recounting of your time in war in Afghanistan and Iraq especially. You tell the story of your time in one of the deadliest encounters for Marines since the Tet Offensive in Fallujah. What led you to write this nonfiction book after writing three books of fiction?
You know, I consider myself primarily a novelist, but the way I do my research is often I'll go to places that I think are interesting or are going to be interesting, and I wind up having experiences and immersing myself in those places, and I work as a journalist along the way. But as I was doing the writing of this book, you know, writing, it is a memoir and essays, but writing a lot of these essays, I realized that the narrative arc, it really wasn't one of a straight line. It was kind of like I was walking in a circle. And so, you know, just like as a circle is, it has a circumference, and each point of the circumference is different. But the one thing all of those different points on the circumference have in common is they have a common center point. So the center point that I was kind of making this orbit around were experiences of mine in Iraq and Afghanistan. So as I'm working as a journalist, witnessing the revolution inside of Syria and reporting on it and reporting on the Middle East, what kind of keeps staring back at me are my own experiences in Iraq and Afghanistan. And that's sort of how I came to realize that I was writing a book.
Yeah. I was struck by one of the early essays. It surrounds an evening in an Istanbul cafe and an evening with Vince. Both of you are Marines who, at that point, were working on the peripheries of the Syrian war. And in this course of this essay, there comes this realization that for so many of people who served in Afghanistan and Iraq, even though their time of serving is over, it's really hard to get away. And this area keeps drawing people back. What is it that is drawing people like Vince and yourself back?
Well, in the scene you mentioned, you know, I'm sitting with Vince, and he and I are sort of new friends in Istanbul, and somewhat surprised to have found one another here on the other side of the planet, having both served in, you know, served in similar parts of Iraq and both served in the Marines. And he's working as an English teacher in a Turkish school. And at a certain point in the evening, I just sort of ask him, I say, "What are you doing here?" And he just kind of smiles with a little laugh and says, "You know, I'm here to be close to it." And he never explained to me what the it was. To me, you know, that it is, you know, an experience that's so large and so intense that, you know, you, your individual sense of self, you kind of shrink into insignificance. You're almost consumed by it. And I think for the war, it's often that type of experience for many folks. And once they've had an experience that's that intense, they're drawn back to try to find one of equal intensity.
Do you feel like you've been drawn to it?
No, I think for anyone, you know, the title of the book is Places and Names on War, Revolution, and Returning. And that last war, returning, is sort of a double entendre. It's both returning home, but also the idea of returning back to the war. And I think I, at one time in my life, found a lot of purpose in deploying to Iraq and Afghanistan, being a Marine. That was my job. And in order to leave that successfully, I had to find a second purpose, which was writing. But certainly a lot of my writing has dealt with conflict, so I still write about the subjects that once had me completely enthralled.
Now, at the time you're writing a lot of these essays, this is a time of the Syrian Civil War and the rise of the Islamic State. And I'm sure you've been asked this question many times, and of course, through the memoir, you're addressing this issue of watching this place in which so many of your close comrades have given blood or died in fighting for, in a case of Iran, watching many of those same regions fall to yet another force, the Islamic State, and your feelings about that. I think part of the book sort of is trying to get at what that is like and what you were fighting for if yet here a decade or less than a decade later, these same areas are overrun by a different force.
Sure. You know, I'm sure it will come as no surprise to you and your listeners that, you know, the reason that if you were to go to Iraq and sit there and have talked to me 15 years ago and asked me why I was fighting there, it would probably come as no surprise to you that I was fighting there for the same reason, you know, most anyone fights in a war. You know, day to day, you're fighting for the guy on your left and the guy on your right. That's what you're the most concerned about. So when it comes to these sort of ideas of, you know, regretting how a war went and the things I think about in the war, they're actually really more personal experiences, individual interactions, firefights I was involved in, where I feel glad and still glad that I was there. And so I don't regret any of that or feel like any of that was futile because I know what I did, I know what other people did for me, and none of that in the moment was futile. But then you get to the idea of the policies, some of the policies our country pursued. And, you know, I think it is a worthy argument to say some of those policies were futile.
My guest today is Elliot Ackerman. He's a journalist, novelist, and former Marine officer who served 5 tours of duty in Iraq and Afghanistan. He's the author of 3 highly acclaimed novels, and his latest book is a memoir, Places and Names, on War, Revolution, and Returning. It's published by Penguin Press. During the course of the first half of the memoir, you're on the peripheries of the Syrian civil war. What drew you back to the civil war itself? You vaguely describe, I think, what you were doing. You were working with another veteran who was doing NGO work of some sort.
You know, I had a friend of mine, and he was doing NGO work, and he let me know that he was going to southern Turkey, and he sort of gave me my ticket to ride down there. And, you know, specifically, I knew that what was going on in Syria in 2012 and 13 and 14 during the revolution was a continuation in many respects of what had begun in Iraq a decade before. And understanding the interplay between those two made me want to go back and see what was going on now in that part of the Middle East. What I saw was that so much of our failed policies in Iraq influenced the Syrian civil war, you know, led to the rise of ISIS. But there were also interesting connections I made. You know, the idea, for instance, my friend Abed, who we mentioned, he was a democratic activist in Syria in the revolution's early days, you know, and he had kind of gone out in the streets in 2011, 2012, and through peaceful protest was demanding democratic reforms in the face of an authoritarian regime, which was the Assad regime. And by the time I met Abed, his revolution had completely collapsed. He had been chased out of his home in Syria by the regime, knew he could probably never go back. And really, he felt a lot of complexity around that experience because he still felt very proud of what he was involved in and the protests he was involved in. But he felt conflicted because he knew those protests had, in effect, led to the destruction of his home. And that arc, that moral arc Abed had gone through of having, you know, the experience he's the most proud of also be the one that he feels the most regret towards, be something that's very central to him, was frankly, it was an emotional arc I recognized in myself. I'm very proud to have served, very proud to have served in Iraq, very proud to have served in Afghanistan, proud of the things I did there, the things I saw my friends do there. But at the same time, there's been so much loss that you feel this profound regret about the experience too. So what I found were these very interesting connections that were not necessarily obvious. You know, the connection in my case between a former American Marine and a former democratic activist from Syria.
Mm-hmm. You describe Abed's story fairly early in the book, and the very first essay is on something called The Triumph of Death is the title of the essay, and it really gets into that moment where the United States could have intervened in the Syrian civil war. And as you well know, our appetite for more conflict at that particular point, there was just no appetite in the United States to do that, even though there was this horrific chemical attack. And your first essay gets into that.
No, what the book does is, you know, it's a memoir and essay. So many of these essays are very, very personal, but I also want to give the reader a sense of context as to how long many of these intractable problems have been going on in the Middle East, and how, you know, the events we've all been seeing in the news are really the most recent iteration of those events. But specific to the essay you mentioned, the triumph of death, it gets into a lot of these questions where there really is no simple answer. And that essay deals with the summer of 2012 and Obama's famous red line, when it seemed as though the U.S. might actually intervene substantively in the Syrian civil war on behalf of the Free Syrian Army. And ultimately, we wound up not intervening in a substantive way. And you know, the war has now progressed on for another 7 years. But I remember, and I write about this, I remember that moment when it looked like we might go launch another war in the Middle East. And I remember looking at a Marine friend of mine and actually saying to him, you know, if they send the 1st Marine Division into northern Syria, you know, I'm going to put on my old camouflage top with my medals, and I'm going to go march on the Capitol, sort of Ronnie Kovic, born on the 4th of July style. Like, this is crazy. We can't go to war again in the Middle East after the last 10 years.
Yeah.
I remember feeling that very intensely. But then I also remember traveling to Syria 5 months later and meeting all of these activists and hearing their expectations for what the United States should have done for them, their hope that when they stood up demanding their freedom that we would have stood with them, and the fact that we didn't, and how brokenhearted and disillusioned they felt by that, and realizing that there's another side of that story. And I don't know how to reconcile the two, and I don't think it's my job to try to reconcile the two, but I hope the writing will show to a reader how there are those conflicting impulses to both, you know, not intervene at home, but also help people who are trying to bring democratic reforms to their country.
You also visited the Kurdish region of Iraq, another place where another people that have, well, they've depended on the United States, they've taken the initiative to help the United States, and yet our willingness to help them has been at times at least ambivalent at best.
Certainly, you know, the Kurds, who have never had a home state to call their own, have a saying, which is, you know, we have no friends but the mountains. Because when a young Kurdish person goes off to fight in the insurgency, they say, you know, we're just going up to the mountains. And, you know, I would preface that as, you know, the Kurds have no friends but the mountains and the United States, at least since 2003. You know, they've been our most staunch ally in the region. But as we've seen in the last couple of years, you know, we have not necessarily been treating the Kurds the way they've hoped we would treated them. And it begs this question, if you look at, you know, the U.S. history and people who have partnered with us, you know, whether it was the Montagnards in Vietnam or elements of certain Mujahideen elements in Afghanistan in the 1980s, you know, up until the Kurds in the present day. We've often turned our backs on our allies when the conflict's over, and just as often that has really come back to bite us in the future.
My guest today is Elliot Ackerman, a novelist and a former Marine officer and the author of a memoir titled Places and Names on War, Revolution, and Returning. It's published by Penguin Press, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. There is a recurring moment in this book that keeps coming up in many of the essays, as you're talking about places far removed from this place that is sort of central, and that is Fallujah, the Battle of Fallujah. There are references throughout the book to it. And finally, towards the end of the book, you actually talk about returning to Fallujah in 2016. You wanted to return to the city to retrace your steps where one of your closest comrades died. The rooftop of a candy store where you directed your platoon in a 10, 12-hour, 14-hour firefight during the Battle of Fallujah. What was that experience like?
Yeah, I think the thing that was most remarkable about going back to Fallujah was how little it had changed and how, you know, it was a city and continues to be a city defined by destruction. And that destruction, unlike some cities that are defined by creation and have layers on them, Fallujah also has its layers, but these layers of destruction. You know, this building was destroyed in the first battle. That building was destroyed in the second battle and the third battle and on and on. And, you know, unlike the experience you will sometimes hear about, you know, veterans going to walk old battlefields when the war is over, what was also interesting was I was going to walk an old battlefield when the war was still going on. And I was there just a few months after the Iraqi military had fought another major battle against ISIS in Fallujah. And so walking through parts of the city and seeing how a second, a third battle had been fought on these same streets, was at times surreal. You know, and I remember at one moment standing in the city, and there was standing on the rooftop of that candy store you mentioned, where my platoon found itself surrounded. And when we left the candy store, we were pinned down in the street for about 20 or 30 minutes, and I was crouching behind these eight little cinder blocks with my radio operator, and we couldn't move. Anyway, that's a memory I've carried around for years and years. And when I was back there, I was standing on the rooftop of that candy store, and I looked down, and those eight little cinder blocks were still stacked there. They hadn't moved. Just a little heap of rubble. And what was surreal was thinking about how much had changed with me in the intervening years. Everything I'd been through, more combat deployments, starting a family, everything. But the little pile of cinder blocks hadn't moved.
Do you come to any conclusions about this time that you served, of seeing this region continually aflame, many times with you as an active participant and then other times as an observer? Do you come to any conclusions after spending so much time in this region observing as opposed to participating?
I wouldn't say that there are conclusions I come to with regards to any specific, you know, policy in the Middle East or political solution to all of these problems. And I wouldn't say I've come to conclusions per se. I hope that what I've come to is deeper insights. You know, war is a place where you can really understand and see the full scope of human nature. On one end of the spectrum, you can see the furthest reaches of our depravity as a human race, the horrible things we're capable of doing to one another. And you experience and see that in war. But on the other end of the spectrum, too, you can see the most incredible acts of courage that we're capable of performing for one another as humans, the most incredible acts of love, you know, and you can witness people literally sacrificing themselves, showing that last measure of love for a friend, which I've seen. So for me, it's not that I've reached these conclusions, but I feel like the wartime experiences has offered me the chance to really see this broad spectrum of what it means to be a person.
It's an amazing memoir. I also wanted like to talk about your most recent novel, Waiting for Eden. This story is another story. Most of your novels have taken other parts of the forces that are participating in these conflicts and Afghanistan and people more from the region. This book is about a veteran coming home horribly, horribly injured. And it's told from the point of view of one of his comrades, his fellow soldiers, who doesn't survive. And it's a story of this horribly, horribly, it's one of these stories that we hear so much from this conflict about how military medical science is keeping more soldiers alive, but in other conflicts, the character of Eden would have died, but here he gets home, and it's this story of his life, what's left of it in a military hospital. Tell us a little bit about this book and why you decided to write it.
Well, as you mentioned, the protagonist of this book is a man named Eden Malcolm, and he has the distinction of being the most grievously wounded man in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, which, if you think about it, with the advances in medical technology that we have today, makes him the most grievously wounded man in the history of war. And, he is being kept alive, and his wife, Mary, is keeping vigil at his bedside. In the opening pages of the book, after a three-year vigil, they have a child, and that child is spending Christmas with Mary's mother, and Mary decides that she's going to go home for Christmas. She's not even sure if her husband knows that she's keeping this vigil. But when she does, he is aware that she leaves, and there's an incident where he basically becomes terrified. And in that panic, he suffers a stroke. And when he suffers a stroke, his mind becomes basically reshuffled. And for the first time, he is conscious of his situation. And he tries to communicate with the outside world what he wants to have happen to him. And so the book is called Waiting for Eden. It could very well be called Mary's Choice, because that choice ultimately falls onto Mary. In terms of why I wrote the book, it is a book set around the war, in so much as the war is what puts Eden in the bed. But the themes that I'm engaging with aren't necessarily specific to the war. You know, it's this idea of, what does it mean keep faith with someone? You know, what does it mean to keep faith with a person who you've loved, who is now in some way diminished? You know, and I think we all have maybe experienced that. You know, maybe some, you know, someone who's gotten sick, a parent who's grown old. You know, how do we continue to do right by these people, and how do we do right by one another? And again, the book is narrated by Eden's dead best friend, who possesses this level of omniscience, and he's able to occupy not only the thoughts of Mary but the thoughts of Eden, and give you the backstory of all three of them. And it is that backstory that allows you to understand eventually the rationale behind Mary's choice.
Yeah. You know, as I was reading that book and Places and Names, I kept having this recurring thought. You know, in nearly every one of our conflicts Americans have been involved in, there's always been maybe a small percentage of Americans that are mostly untouched by the war. Usually the very rich, those who can profit from it or buy their way out of serving. But in these conflicts we've had here in the 21st century, our longest wars ever, those percentages are absolutely flipped. You know, even if you didn't have somebody serving, you were following the conduct, the progress and the cost of the war. And I think those numbers are just absolutely, you know, just a small percentage of Americans are fighting this war abroad and home and the aftermath today. And I just kept thinking about this as I read both of these books. Is that some small part of what you're trying to address in your own writing?
Well, I you know, I think I'm certainly, you know, writing about this topic and hoping that people who are not otherwise engaged with these wars will engage with them emotionally through, you know, through my work, whether my novels or my journalism or this book of nonfiction. And, you know, I think we as a country are in uncharted waters with how we are currently waging war. You know, we've never done it this way before. You know, every war we fought, from the Civil War to World War II to Vietnam, had a construct around it. What I mean by that is, you know, the Civil War, we funded that war with partially through the first ever income tax, and we had the first ever draft was also in the Civil War. To the Second World War, we had war bond drives and another draft. In Vietnam, we obviously had a famously unpopular draft. You know, these wars have been constructed so they're fought by an all-volunteer military, and they're funded through deficit spending. Meaning there's no taxes paid on them. We just borrow more money when we need to fund the wars. And to me, it's very clear that is why they have lasted for 18 years, because we've been anesthetized to them as a society. You only feel it if you want to feel it, if you want to join the military, if you have a loved one in the military. And I think we need to ask ourselves, you know, whether that puts us in a position of moral hazard if we are, you know, what we profess to be, which is a democratic republic. You know, in a democratic republic, the whole country should go to war. And this year, 2019, marks, I think, a particularly grim and largely unobserved milestone in our country. So this year is the first time in the history of our country that a young person can go enlist to fight in a war that is older than they are. Mm. That's never happened before.
That is a sad, sad story. Mm-hmm. Well, Elliot Ackerman, I appreciate your writing. The name of the new book is Places and Names. Thank you so much for taking time to speak with me.
Thanks so much for having me.
Novelist and journalist Elliot Ackerman speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. His latest book is titled Places and Names: On Wars, Revolution, and Returning. It's published by Penguin Press. He'll be appearing at a BookSmart Tulsa event tonight at 7 o'clock at Magic City Books in the Tulsa Arts District. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.